Hi, I'm Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and today we're going to be talking about getting energy efficiency data from utilities and any updates of energy efficiency programs in different states that anybody else might have to offer. So our speaker, primary speaker today is Catherine Johnson with Johnson Consulting, and she'll start us off. Clayne and Rob, Christian and Barton, attorney at Christian and Barton, will also be discussing a little bit about this, and anybody else in the group who has anything to add can certainly add on to it. So, Catherine, why don't you give us an update of what do you need to do to get information from utilities?
That's the first thing, and I was thinking about this earlier today, is I guess you have to figure out from what perspective are you seeking the information. Are you seeking the information as the evaluator, which is a role I often play in utilities?
Catherine, do you want to pick up your phone a little closer?
Is that better? Okay. So, good morning. Good afternoon. So, basically, when I was thinking about this topic this morning, it occurred to me that really the way to get data first begins with your perspective. I mean, what is the purpose of the data, or why do you need the data? For example, as an evaluator, I would need the data from utility program databases to evaluate the programs successfully, and it's always a trick to try and have understand how they lay out data, how a utility would lay out data, and often the data fields aren't even aligned within the same utility or even within the same group of programs, like a portfolio program. They may have a residential program and a C&I programs, and the data may be completely aligned completely differently. So the first thing is, what do we need the data for? The second thing is, what are you going to do with the data in terms of what information is really critical to meet your particular needs? If you're an advocacy group or an intervener, you're going to be wanting to look at different kinds of information than, say, an evaluator would or a vendor or implementer would. So it's really a matter of, depending on how you're approaching the utility, understanding clearly what the data needs are, and more importantly, being able to say, well, I need the data because. You have to have a clear-cut reason for issuing a data request, just to say, well, I just want to see your data, because then they can do everything. They can either say that's too vague, or the utility can give you a lot of and drown you in data, and that isn't really going to help. So the very first thing is to have to start with your perspective of what do you need it for, and then how are you going to use it. And lastly, what are you going to report back to the utilities? Are you going to give them a summary of their data? Are you just looking for are you trying to compare it to other utility programs? So, you know, what is the end product that you're, going to be, are you going to be putting it back, or are you going to be filing in testimony? So I guess it has a lot to do with, let's frame the question and then we'll figure out how to get the answer. So that's the first thing I have.
Okay.
I don't know if that was helpful or not, but that's what I got.
Well, it's always helpful, Catherine. You're an extraordinary person, very knowledgeable. So I'm going to open this up. Clayne, do you have some questions? Do you have some comments about this or some questions?
Yeah. I was seeing the question maybe a little bit differently than Catherine is, because it sounds like Catherine's looking at taking a utility program and evaluating it in some way. I often work with individual customers, local government customers, mm-hmm. large industrial customers, and the way they come at it is they've got someone who's helping them implement, say, an energy efficiency measure. And
right.
The folks that do that on behalf of the customer are frustrated, at least in Virginia, dealing with Virginia utilities terms of getting access to individual customer data. So, they can always, of course, get the usage data from the customer, but that's often time-consuming and delayed, and just not a good solution to the problem. So, what these folks would like to do is get the customer data, individual customer data, directly from the utility. Always, of course, with the customer's permission, but they'd like to get it. As close to real time as they could, and they'd like to get it electronically rather than in paper. So, Catherine, have you run into that situation?
Yes.
Where you're – okay.
Absolutely. Okay. So, well, we've run into that situation in just trying to pull data from Virginia utilities, say I'm doing a program evaluation of a residential customer, residential customer, and I mean program, let's just say, some sort of residential widget program, okay? And I want to do a participant and a non-participant survey. So we want to, and we also want to maybe do billing analysis where we want to pull the usage to compare what the customer's usage was before and after they installed whatever widget they installed. I've had numerous challenges with just, A, trying to get a random sample of residential customers to call them up and ask them questions about, do they know about the program? What do they think about the utility basic? This is pretty standard evaluation, standard stuff. And then also, it's often tricky to get data that goes back in time so we can get a good, robust sample to compare the folks before they entered the program until after they entered the program so we can look at their billing history for a year, say. That's what we have to do. So, and the problem has to do with the challenges that lurk within the utility itself. For example, some utilities I had asked them to help when I was setting up their evaluations forgot to collect the customer phone numbers, even though I specifically said that's a really good data field to collect when we're collecting everything else on a rebate application. And they had to go back and key in all those. They had it on the application, but they didn't have it in their database, so they had to, you know, it took a couple weeks for them to basically have a bunch of customer service reps key in the data, the phone numbers. And I was like, this is sort of the basic duh, you know, like, are you kidding me kind of thing. So so a lot of it has to do with inexperience or just they only want what they need and they don't really care about it from a utility, you know, from a utility perspective. Why do you need it? It's our data. It's, you know, I know it's your customer, but why don't you care? I mean, they don't really get the fact that maybe the customers want that information so they can make an informed decision. So, which is why your implementers want the data, is to say we need to look at your usage so then we can make a decision if installing this particular piece of equipment is going to be a good idea and save you or not. So the utilities, unless they're involved in the program, really don't have the level of sophistication to understand the purpose of that data. And that's one of the big hang-ups. That and there also have their own, even within the utility, people don't understand how to access the database. So
right.
It's not just us. It's IT is a, you know, sacrosanct kind of department, and, you know, you have to write special, you have to get special permission. And then it's becoming even worse with the new customer privacy laws that have taken effect. In fact, when I do a lot of work in Arkansas, and that was a huge concern is, can customers be called? You know, are we violating confidentiality by calling up a non-participant and asking them about a program that they maybe didn't participate in? Even a general awareness question, are we somehow violating their privacy issues? That thankfully was resolved. But the point is, utilities are very, very defensive of wanting to make sure they're not going to get sued by an angry customer because they gave up their name for someone to call them. So yeah. It's a very touchy issue right now. And it's just, I think it's going to get even worse with the level of customer, I mean, it's good we have customer protections, but we should also allow customers to opt in or opt out of those kinds of activities too. So.
And, you know, one of the reasons I'm particularly interested is because Virginia, at least according to folks that follow this more closely than I, is not exactly at the forefront of
not at all.
Implementing.
I do work in Virginia.
Programs.
They're not.
So,
they're
there's. We've had a huge focus on this issue in the current legislative session because the utilities have been kind of called out for over-collecting on rates, and now there's a bill to kind of fix that, and there's huge debate as to whether the customer rebates are sufficient or not, and along with the big compromise bill that's before the it got debated yesterday in the Senate Commerce and Labor Committee and is being debated today in the House Commerce and Labor Committee. There was a big compromise bill, and as part of that compromise bill to, you know, kind of get as many people as possible to support this utility fix, if you will, to the rate refund problem, they're proposing to put in $870 million in energy efficiency programs over the next 10 years. So the question that occurs to me, and I come at this from a customer perspective, so I'm kind of appalled at that we didn't get more in rate refunds out of this. But setting that aside, if you've got an $870 million investment in energy efficiency programs over the next 10 years, you know, how can we make sure they do that wisely? Now, part of the compromise that went into this was energy efficiency proponents have been frustrated with our Public Utilities Commission mm-hmm. because the utilities do have an opportunity, and they take advantage of it, it's particularly Dominion, to come before the commission and say, here's your slate of energy efficiency programs, commission, please sign off on it. And the commission applies various tests, including the ratepayer impact measure test, and a lot of times the utilities will propose something and the commission will reject it because it doesn't show sufficient cost benefit. So another piece of this legislation is to basically knock out the ratepayer impact measurement test as a block to utility programs. So it seems like on the cost-benefit analysis on the Public Utility Commission side, we may be addressing what a lot of energy efficiency proponents have seen as a problem. But the question I have is, okay, if you've got $870 million, how can we spend it wisely to make sure that these utility programs provide the maximum benefit to customers
right.
who are implementing the programs?
Right.
So are there like best practices or,
yes.
you know, other?
Actually, I've worked extensively in Virginia for the last, a long time. And
okay.
And I also work as an advisor to public utility commissions around the country, too. And,
okay.
and in comparison, so for example, until a week ago when my contract expired in California, which is not at all unusual these days, I was an advisor to, say, the California Public Utilities Commission. I've also been an advisor to a few others around the country. And I also work as an evaluator in about 10 other states, including Virginia. And I have to say, first of all, there's a couple things I want to make clear. The Virginia Public Utilities Commission has, for some reason, always opposed energy efficiency programs, even when they were being proposed by not just the electric utilities, but also the gas utilities. And they have set up, I believe, as an evaluator, artificially high standards for them to even approve programs. For example, in best practices in program design, you're going to design a portfolio of programs. So let's just take an easy example. You're a utility, and let's just say you're just do gas because it's easier. Let's say you're a gas utility, and gas only has a few end uses. You have insulation, heating. You can do water heating, and you can do furnaces or change-outs for furnaces. So what happens when the utility design, the best practice is you take a whole bunch of different measures and you compare different scenarios, and you say, okay, what combination of measures will be the most cost-effective, that is a ratio above 1.0, where the benefits are at least equal to the costs or even better. And most states use the total resource cost test or a version sometimes called the societal cost test. Very few states actually use the ratepayer impact measure test or the participant test, just because they're trying to look at the benefit as a whole to society, the total resource cost, because utilities are basically regulated monopolies. So the very basic premise I'm getting at is when you look at just one test, you end up with this patchwork quilt of utility programs like they do in Virginia. For example, there are gas utilities in Virginia that I work with where they offer heating, they want to offer a complete comprehensive heating package for a residential customer. They want to make able to offer insulation, water heating, and furnaces and furnace tune-ups. They can't do that under the current way that the efficiency is set up in Virginia. They can't do it at the portfolio level. They have to do it at the measure level. Well, the measure level doesn't really necessarily, because furnaces cost more than insulation, they're not going to necessarily pass at the program level, but they will pass at the portfolio level. So without getting too complicated, what happens is you have a gas utility that can offer a water heating program in one jurisdiction. You have a different gas utility that can offer a furnace replacement program in another jurisdiction. You have contractors that go between both jurisdictions because maybe these utilities are next to each other. And they're very confused, and they say, well, I can get, if you're a customer of XYZ utility in Northern Virginia, you can get a furnace rebate, but I can't give you a water heating rebate. And by the way, you need a new furnace and a new water heater. But if you're down in the, next town over in the other service territory, I can give you a water heating rebate, but not a furnace. So the point is that it becomes very complicated for the contractors who promote these programs. It becomes really difficult for the utility customers. Say they talk to each other and like, well, I got a rebate for a furnace. How come you didn't? And more importantly, it becomes a very very difficult way to say, why am I looking at the measure level when the whole purpose of energy efficiency is to look at the whole house, look at how do we bundle measures together to get the best amount of savings. It's really silly to put in a new furnace if you haven't done proper ceiling insulation, because then it doesn't matter how efficient your furnace is if you have a hole in your roof. And that's an extreme example, but that's sort of why most energy efficiency programs are designed to be holistic in approach, and that's why the measure level, looking at just like, does this measure pass or fail, is really a short-sighted approach. In fact, one utility that I'm working with in Virginia, a gas utility, they got approval for a measure that hasn't been installed in Virginia since the 1980s. Guess what? They didn't have any installations because nobody sells that measure, but it was cost effective. So why did you even bother? So the point is that these kinds of approaches really negate the whole purpose of what an energy efficiency portfolio is supposed to do. Now, the flip side, your concern as a ratepayer, wait a minute, I want to make sure that the energy efficiency programs I'm providing are going to be good costs, the benefits are going to outweigh the costs. Well, part of what they do in a participant cost is they look at the benefits to the customer and also well as the benefits to the utility. And that's the participant test. The ratepayer impact measure is more looking at it at a narrower approach where they're just looking at the basics. They don't look about, well, how much does the customer have to pay to get the program? So it's a little bit of a different test, and there's a lot of discussion, a lot of controversy about which cost-benefit tests should be used. In fact, there's a new one coming out called the National Standard Practice Model that's coming out, and it's being sort of saying, hey, because of the very issues you're raising, I don't know if the costs are really beneficial to the customers, to the ratepayers, and to society as a whole. So they're trying to say, well, every utility portfolio is different. They have different costs. They have different benefits. Let's look at it in a different way. So I'm sorry that's a long-winded answer, but the short answer is the cost tests are often sometimes not the only way to look at the benefits of a program. We also have to look at just the sensibility of, does it really make sense to have a gas utility that has a water heating program and next jurisdiction over one that has a furnace rebate program, and why can't they both offer furnace and water heating? If the end goal is to improve the overall stock and to improve overall energy efficiency, and I can tell you, if you put in a new energy efficiency furnace or a new energy efficiency water heater, you're going to get savings. It's going to be measurable savings, and it's a good investment. So it's the point where the commission tries to micromanage these at the program level without really understanding the whole thought of energy efficiency. It's not just a one widget and go away. It's supposed to be a holistic approach. You may start with lighting and then go to insulation and then go to HVAC equipment and then maybe other things. But, you know, it's the idea is it's not just one, you're one and done. That's the whole notion of energy efficiency, at least the way I've been doing it for 25 years.
No, thank you. That's really helpful.
You got me talking, Sierra.
Yes, I was hoping for that. I knew better. So anyhow, everybody is muted except I have two people on here who have no names, and I don't know who they are. One is a 626 number, 890836. Do you want to? I'm going to unmute you and let you guys tell me who you are.
Okay, this is George Wilkie, Sierra.
Oh, hi, George. Okay, good. And then we have one person who very likely is Evan. Are you on here, Evan?
Yes, this is Evan. I'm on Skype.
Okay, gotcha. Your Skype doesn't have a number next to it, so I kind of usually assume it's you. So everybody's unmuted right now. If you have any questions for Catherine or any comments about this, any information about what's going on in your area,
yeah,
please.
Yeah, set me straight. That's fine.
Please dive in. Otherwise, Catherine, no, go ahead. Go ahead, Evan.
Hearing that, I've been listening to accounts of utilities seeming to get their way with PUCs, or at least some PUCs, on energy conservation efficiency issues related to customers. I would hope that there's a good side of this, but I don't have examples of the good side of this. The good side of it would be that utilities actually have a way to make as much return on energy conservation efficiency measures as they do on new generation.
Yes, they do. That's the whole theory.
Been hearing for years that, for 40 years, that the lowest cost electricity is the kilowatt hour that you don't have to generate.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I'm dissatisfied with what I hear specifically about utilities really having an incentive so that their stockholders do as well on energy conservation investments as they do on generation or transmission and distribution now investments.
Yeah, in Virginia, the law has been and will continue to be that utilities can earn a margin on operating expenses for energy efficiency. So normally they don't. Normally they just get a margin, a rate of return on capital expenses. But for energy efficiency programs, that general rule is voided, and they can get the return, the rate of return on operating expenses. So the utilities have taken care of themselves in that regard in Virginia.
Any other questions here?
This is Sherry. Can you hear me?
Yes, we're good.
Huh? Oh, hi. I'm Sherry Gruder. I'm calling from Wisconsin, and I'd like to go back to more the local government level, and I do a lot of kind of energy independent communities planning or more sustainable energy planning with local governments. And one of the things that we're working on and more cities are interested in now are getting to 100% renewable energy. And of course the only way to do that is to drastically reduce energy use. So energy efficiency is really, you know, a big part of that. So one of the things that we've been doing is asking for not only the local government data, which takes a lot, because we've been establishing, you know, at least 3 years of data to give them a baseline of, you know, what they use so that they can see what to upgrade. But when we ask the utilities for information about the commercial use of energy, especially when cities are looking at, you know, should we require energy benchmarking of the commercial sector? Well, first of the city and then of the commercial sector, because they are the biggest energy users compared to the local government operations. We run into proprietary, you know, saying that, oh, well, we can't release that, although we're not asking for, you know, business per business. And they're so uncooperative, and I'm just wondering if they're, and of course we're a regulated state in Wisconsin, so, you know, we've got that issue as well, but I'm just wondering if there are some approaches or fixes around that, because we do know what we're asking our utilities for, but they're not very helpful. And it doesn't seem like we're all trying to get to the same end.
Yeah, and I'll just say that that's the concern I've heard on my end from customers. So I know we have that same issue, you know, from the individual customer perspective.
This is Catherine again. Unfortunately, it gets back to some of the silly things I was talking about earlier in terms of the utilities maybe don't understand what you're asking for, or they just don't want to get the data because it requires a lot of hoops for them, which isn't fair to you guys, but it's their, you know, they're not the most transparent organizations to understand in the first place, and they want to basically do their job, and they don't really want to, they don't want to get bothered. I hate to say it. They just don't. So, you know, I'm a little candid here, but that's been my experience, that you have to really, again, make the case about why this information is important and why you're trying to get it and explain to them the purpose, because otherwise they're like, why are you bothering me? Even if maybe they already know and they still don't want to do it. I don't know.
Well, I think, you know, part of it is their database is set up for ease of use for them, when you ask them to do something different, it at a minimum takes some labor costs, and at a maximum may require some software changes. So there is certainly time and likely expense on the utilities. So I wonder if, you know, maybe if, particularly in Virginia, if we've got 700 or 870 million to play with over the next 10 years, whether, you know, some of that shouldn't be focused on, all right, what's, you know, what incentives or what programs or what needs to be done for utilities to make this piece of it, the data exchange piece, more easy. You know, so I understand that you have to put a lot of that into the actual programs, but I do wonder if maybe part of that money couldn't be put towards systems where you can just make the data readily accessible to customers or folks who are working with customers.
Right.
It also seems that the utilities are concerned or being risk-averse or just overly, you know, protective of their commercial customers when they're not giving away any trade secrets. I mean, you know, we're looking at businesses of, you know, whatever, 100,000 square feet or more, you know, how much energy are they using, you know, versus, you know, how much are businesses in 50,000 to 100,000 square feet, et cetera, so that we can look at, you know, creating benchmarking goals that get at the biggest users and that we know where we're starting from and we can measure, you know, how the progress that we make.
And I know in Virginia we've had, you know, again, as part of this global settlement bill, we've had a lot of movement on renewable generation. And part of that got started by, you know, some big users coming in, with data centers, also Microsoft, you know, Microsoft, Amazon, also Target and Walmart saying, you know what, we want renewable generation and Virginia's going to figure out a way to get it to us. So I wonder if you had some of those same voices, you know, making noises about energy efficiency, whether you get, you know, some relief, you know, in this area. Because you're, yeah.
Well, and the other thing is the contract, and, you know, the residential customers are not really a money-making part of the utility business. The way they make their money is the commercial industrial or the large users. So they're very, very protective of those users, and that's why they're also maybe reluctant to give you information because they don't want to make them angry. You know, that's they really care about them. That's one of the things that may also be a problem.
Yeah, and I respect the fact that, you know, commercial users, some in particular, are sensitive about anyone getting access to their usage information.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that there's a way to gather data. You know, and of course, with local governments, you do worry about freedom of information requests. So you don't want sensitive utility data getting in the hands of local governments and then it becoming somehow public. So I do understand that those concerns are valid. I just have to think that there's workarounds so the local governments can get the benchmarking they need without sacrificing the legitimate privacy concerns of the businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll keep working on it.
Good luck.
Is there a reason why it couldn't be done anonymously so that you're getting the data but not necessarily for...
Yeah, I think that that's ideal, but say it's a local county that's got a data center and pretty much nothing else in terms of large usage. So, you know, that may be where you run into concerns about, you know, well, if this is the benchmark for the large user in our area, we know who it is. So that would be the only thing. That would be a situation where simply anonymity might not be sufficient. But in bigger areas, like Fairfax County, we've got a ton of big users. I would think that'd be less of an issue.
Well, as far as I'm not wanting to offer this information because of the amount of time and money it would take, is there any way that you could offer them something to do that? Pay them.
Well,
because when you go
I
to get databases otherwise, you have to pay for them generally.
Yeah, that's where I think the commission could come in. You know, the same Public Utility Commission that we said has not been very helpful up to now. You know, that is where I think the commission could play a role in being helpful and saying, look, part of this $870 million has to be devoted to getting utility software up to date so that customers can readily access their own information. I mean, ideally, you make it easy for customers to share it with, you know, whoever it needs to be shared with so that it's the customer's call, but it can be done readily. Right now, customers can share their information, their own information with anybody that they like, but it's not that easy.
Well, one of the things we're looking at is across the country, it's not just Sierra Club, but Sierra Club has a program called Getting to 100, and there are over 50 cities that have adopted resolutions to generate 100% of their electricity. Some of them just have an electricity goal by a date, which is normally somewhere between 2040 and 2050, fully from renewable energy. Some of them have adopted community-wide renewable energy of, you know, including heating and transportation fuels, you know, by a later date. And so in order to do that, you know, getting data is really important. And I'm finding that the utilities where there are cities pushing them to get there are getting more sensitive to this because they're realizing that their old model isn't working, and there are places like Boulder, Sierra, where, you know, the cities have said, or Austin, you know, we're municipalizing our utility, or you know, this isn't working for us, so we're going to find a way to get our energy some other way.
Yeah, it's a long slog, I can tell you that.
Yeah, the Boulder municipalization is probably, I think that's more of an outlier. I was on the board for the city of Winter Park in Florida, which was one of the first cities in the country to municipalize, and that's one of the areas Boulder, they consulted with us on that, actually. But that's rare. It's very hard to, you know, take over a utility. And in Winter Park, believe me, we learned that they hadn't been tree trimming, they hadn't maintained the transformers. You know, it was a lot to take on for a little city. So I don't know if cities are going to want to start municipalizing, but you do have a good point where there are alternative generation out there, and if the utilities don't become more customer-centric, then they may have to think about, well, what happens when they become self-generating? What happens when they generate their own, you know, renewable energy? Then how are we going to, you know, then what's going to happen? So to some degree, it is going to take them to, a little bit more awareness for the utilities and maybe a little more pain for them to realize that we need to step up and make these guys happy. Otherwise, you know, they'll find other alternatives, which I think was the heart of what you were saying.
Boulder's been at this probably for 7 years now. We're still not sure if we can achieve the goal.
Yeah,
so
Winter Park did it because nobody wanted it.
Yeah,
it's a little different than Boulder.
Xcel Energy is not a happy camper right now.
Right. Well, Florida Progress was willing to sell assets, and they wanted to get out of the game because they weren't making any money.
That helps a lot. I wish you could talk to Xcel about that.
But so it's a tricky, as you can see, it's a tricky deal for a city to municipalize. But more of a bigger danger is for them to become, for these big companies like the big organizations we're talking about, to say, you know what, I don't need your stinking power. I'll get it somewhere else. And that is, you know, back in the olden days when I was first in the business, one of the things that really scared the big utilities were cogeneration facilities. It was in Detroit, and what happens if the auto industry starts to do their own cogen, and they don't need Detroit Edison or any of the utilities in Michigan, and they can also go buy their power from Canada. So that kind of got them to sort of understand they needed to take care of these customers rather than and meet them where they are, as opposed to losing them. So there is some incentive for them to have to step up. I'm hoping. again, I'm an optimist, so we'll
right.
see.
Well,
we're all optimists, Catherine.
But you know, we also have some big corporate, you know, entities out there. Like in Wisconsin, we have Gunderson Health System. It said, you know, if we're a health system, we can't be part of the problem, and we're going to 100% clean energy. And they actually have achieved the goal, you know. So, you know, if you have these really huge businesses kind of taking themselves off the grid, so to speak, in some way, in some respect, you know, that makes a difference.
Yes. And also, and Walmart and Whole Foods have adopted, you know, very, very aggressive energy conservation / renewable policy. And public relations, it's great, but they're doing it because it enhances their bottom line. If they don't have to spend it on energy, they can, you know, improves their profits. So but Walmart is a big enough entity, and Whole Foods, which I think is now owned by Amazon, are certainly big enough entities where they can, you know, make those kinds of investments. Unfortunately, cities and other organizations don't necessarily have the wherewithal or the ability to make those kinds of investments. But that's, again, where a public service commission can improve incentive programs targeting these kinds of activities, telling the utilities you have to cooperate, and we'll give you an incentive if you do. The utilities will get money, you know, they'll get a way to recoup their losses, and the customers will get. So there is a positive role for the public service commissions to play in these instances, and that's usually where they've had this kind of progress has been made. Unfortunately, that isn't necessarily the case in some of the places we're talking about.
That depends if the PSC or the PUC has been, I hate to say it, but politicized.
Exactly.
You know, yeah.
Jerry, do you have anything to weigh in on this? I see that you're here.
No, it's been an interesting conversation. You know, I would say just that I think things are a little better in California. It certainly in terms of, you know, the pervasive smart meters and the fact that you really can go online and get a lot of data for yourself, for individual customers, sharing it, accessing the data in a form that you could use for local planning, local resource planning. Is tougher primarily because of the kinds of issues that the speakers have been, you know, bringing up. That's probably something that community choice helps to solve because you know, the community choice agency has the ability to process the data that, you know, they're getting some of the data directly from the utilities. They can process it in ways that the utilities may not, the grid owner utilities may not be equipped to do. And they, you know, basically local jurisdictions are members of their boards. And so if they want the data, you know, they have some leverage with the community choice agency to get some help. But that would be my comment.
So George Wilsey is one of our new members here, and he's online with Clean Powerhouse. George, do you have anything to say about any of this?
No, I'm just listening carefully. Thank you, though.
All right. How about you, Craig?
You know, I'm sorry. I'm dealing with a whole bunch of urgencies over here, so I've only been a small percentage of the time been able to listen in, but I've enjoyed what I've heard. I will just say that, Sierra, that you've conducted a couple of recent events that I think are really applicable. There was the community microgrid presentation that Greg Thompson from the Clean Coalition gave. I think that was just 2 weeks ago, maybe.
Right.
I was on vacation, so I missed that too. For the feedback I've heard from lots of folks was that was a really useful presentation, webinar. And And then I will also say that the Clean Coalition that same week, which I think now was 2 weeks ago, that same week, Clean Coalition gave a presentation on conducting distribution resources planning, DRP. And the Clean Coalition, we designed the legislation in California that forced the CPUC to force the utilities to actually to plan their distribution grids. And so that presentation, that webinar was conducted through the Clean Coalition directly, and that is available for download, or you can watch the one-hour webinar from our website, the Clean Coalition website. So I would encourage people who are struggling with these issues of not having access, or, you know, or their utilities in their jurisdictions not being properly mandated to actually plan their distribution grids and to make that information available to other parties to see what's happened in California. And the Clean Coalition drove that whole process in California over about a seven-year time period. We're trying to proliferate what happened in California to other states to make it happen in a two-, three-year time period. But if you don't get started now, you're never going to get it. Or if you don't get started, you're never going to get it. So I just encourage people to see that DRP webinar that the Clean Coalition has on its website from about 2 weeks ago.
Super. And that's cleancoalition.org. So
that's correct. And if you just Google it, right, we're the top, you know, 10 hits at least. So just Clean Coalition, go to our main website. Go to our past events, and there'll be a whole bunch of events there, but find the one on distribution resources planning, DRP, as it's lovingly referred to, and easily accessible to view the webinar or download the actual presentation.
All right. Is there any way to aggregate some of these solutions as far as energy efficiency is concerned? As far as cities go, it seems like that may be an interesting way of approaching it. Nobody? Okay, I know that Bear Grounds worked with aggregating streetlights, with aggregating cities, I should say, on implementing or installing streetlights in multiple cities within a county and Pennsylvania. So I was curious to know if there's any way you aggregate the types of appliances and such that you need, or cities for offering appliances and such to their citizens and utilities. No? Okay. Anybody?
Sarah, this is Craig. I wanted to pause and just see if anybody else chimed in to that question. I'll just offer a couple of thoughts. One is that in California, through the community choice aggregation, you have those are generally county-wide jurisdictions, and so they include a whole bunch of cities. And so the community choice aggregation jurisdictions are essentially, and for those who don't know what a community choice aggregator is, it's basically a it is a load-serving entity, kind of like an ESCO, except all they do is buy energy, and then they essentially have the relationship with the customer to have that energy delivered, and you know they can control the rate and all that stuff that people get energy. And in California, the focus is to increase the percentage of that energy that's renewables compared to the investor-owned utilities that would otherwise be serving those customers. So I think that a lot of the CCAs, especially like Marin Clean Energy and Sonoma Clean Power, they've implemented some really great programs around electric vehicles and I believe also around energy efficiency. Peninsula Clean Energy in San Mateo County, where I live, I think you know, they're definitely looking to do a lot of really innovative stuff. So I think that would be a good place to look and might make for a very interesting presentation, by the way. The other thought that I'll just throw out there is that we in California, you know, has been devastated by a number of disasters this year or, you know, kind of in the last 12 months between fires and mudslides. And the Clean Coalition is working on a Sonoma, what we call the Sonoma Initiative, and we are also working on the Montecito Community Microgrid Project which is down in Santa Barbara. And then the Sonoma is obviously in the Sonoma County, which is north of San Francisco. And these are areas that have just been ravaged by natural disasters. And so we're looking to, in both these instances, to make sure that energy efficiency is a really central part of the rebuild effort and, you know, maximizing energy efficiency and you know, upgrading the grid so you can do full community microgrid functionality. And so we're working with the utilities and the municipalities and multiple municipalities, obviously, throughout the county of Sonoma. And then even in Santa Barbara, we've got multiple cities there. We've got Santa Barbara City, Goleta, Carpinteria, and then you've got the Santa Barbara County. And all of those communities, all those municipalities are working together. So we've got some opportunities, you know, kind of the perfect storm, so to speak, you know, literally and figuratively, to bring these municipalities together and to work together. And we're seeing a lot of cooperation from, you know, various municipalities that otherwise would be very difficult to bring together just because they're big bureaucracies and, you know, not invented here and all the normal stuff that you have when you're trying to deal with municipalities.
Yes, California is a whole different animal over there. I wish the whole rest of the country were able to do a lot of the things that you're able to do over there. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you for sharing that. That's wonderful. My daughter lives in Goleta and had to be evacuated because of the fires. And I didn't know about that. I will let her know.
Yeah, super. It's actually, you know, we haven't made any public announcement yet about the Montecito Community Microgrid, but we will soon. It's just kicking off, and we're getting a ton of traction on it. And in addition, the Clean Coalition has been working with UCSB to do a community microgrid there. And as you may know, since your daughter lives in Goleta, UCSB is the primary emergency sheltering site for all of Santa Barbara County. And we're going to do a renewables grid there.
Wow.
Any other comments here? Kind of drifted a little bit off our energy efficiency topic.
This is Evan Hughes. My comment was that the answer to the question I asked about utilities having incentive to invest capital in energy conservation efficiency, the answer, at least for Virginia, is that there are essentially regulations that they have to comply with on energy conservation, and money that they spend as operating expenses gets to earn a marginal return. That's not the same as return on capital, although depending on the numbers, it might be the equivalent in terms of incentive for the utilities. Does anyone have any further examples or comments on that?
Well, this is Cleaner Rob. It is the equivalent in Virginia. It's the same profit.
Mm-hmm. The problem they're trying to solve would be that the customer may not get a good enough return on investment to do the front end cost, or simply even though it would be a good investment, that they don't spend it, but the utility could put up the money for the what to the customer would be a capital improvement, like improving the house in some way. But and the utility should be able to earn a return on that. That was my idea.
Okay.
One of the things that's really catching on here is we just had 27 counties adopt PACE, Property Assessed Clean Energy Financing, where maybe all of you know about PACE, but it's where a private bank or funder finances energy efficiency upgrades, but they're charged to the business entity, because right now for us anyway, it's all commercial, but they're charged on the property taxes and they stay with the property. So we have that as another way that businesses are now able to do major upgrades, like $30 million you know, wholesale upgrades of old buildings and their energy efficiency without having to pay the costs up front. So that's kind of another thing in the mix.
It's amazing how much is going on in Wisconsin, considering.
Yeah.
Well, it just goes to show that there's a lot of other reasons for trying to move forward on renewable energy than, you know, and getting beyond policies. So any other thoughts or comments here? Okay. Well, it's almost an hour. So we're going to have a webinar in a couple of on the 20th here, talking about different ways of procuring energy. Yeah, George Wiltsey will be the one who will be conducting that, our new member here. And it looks like it could be a really interesting conversation about different ways of working with energy procurement, different examples. So anyhow, hope you can make that, and we'll have another call in a couple of weeks. I'll be sending out invitations for that as well. Thanks for coming, and I'll talk to you all soon.
Thank you.
Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks to Catherine and Kalina, of course.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I know. I'll be really interested to talk to you again after March.
Okay.